Afrique victime de tant de crimes, si nous nous tîmes, il nous dessine.
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 113, Africa's Buildings. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today, our guest is Ito Osayimwese. She is a professor at Brown University of Art and Architecture and Urban Studies, and she's the affiliate faculty in Africana Studies at the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies. She is here today because she is the author of Africa's Buildings, Architecture and the Displacement of Cultural Heritage. Ito, welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So the first thing I would want to ask is, I think there is a emerging understanding within the art world, certainly, that there was a huge theft of African artifacts and art over the past several centuries, really, that were effectuated as part of campaigns of colonialism. And there is a concerted effort now to return any number of those artifacts. But your book does something a little different, which is that it differentiates between art and architecture. My first question is, why is it important to make that distinction?
Great question. Why is it important to differentiate between art and architecture in this ongoing discussion and debate about the repatriation and restitution of African material cultural heritage? Well, first of all, I think it is important to place even the category of art within the larger category of material cultural heritage, because art is, you know, more or less a Western concept. And it's also, even in the West, it's a modern concept, right? We didn't really differentiate between like the fine arts and, you know, other types of arts and crafts until relatively recently in the Western world. And it's the same in other parts of the world, right? That distinction is a little bit, it's a little bit unhelpful, right? Because there are objects and things that are artistic and, of, you know, aesthetically pleasing, but also functional. And in our Western kind of idea of what art is, it tends to be not functional, right? And so that I wanted to start out by just saying that that distinction is already kind of flawed wherever you applied. And it's definitely flawed when you think about especially sub-Saharan African architectural and art histories, but also Northern, you know, Africa and Egypt, which obviously are all included on the African continent. And from my perspective, it's really important to make that distinction because it actually, let's say, it makes the case for restitution and repatriation of objects that are now in collections in the United States and various countries in Europe and even in Asia. Stronger, right? Because if you understand some of these quote unquote works of art, and that's how they're often, you know, framed. And I agree, they're beautiful. They're works of art. They have aesthetic value. But if you understand them as parts of much bigger and larger structures, right? Then it completely, in my view, changes the perspective because then you start to ask, wait a minute. Okay, so this is actually like a lintel from a building. You know, you may start to ask, how did it get here? What happened to the building that, you know, this lintel was part of? Because lintels are kind of important components of buildings. So it's no longer just, okay, this portable art object that, you know, somehow somebody got from some place on the African continent and is now in a museum and you can look at it, but it is something much more, you know, significant in terms of how it was removed and the effects of its loss or removal.
Right. I mean, the word violence comes up a lot in your characterization of how these objects arrived in, you know, Western or European hands. And that's really important. And it's obviously reinforced by the fact that it's like, oh yeah, they had to destroy an entire building to get this piece. Like it wasn't just like, oh, I found it. You know, it doesn't, it puts you further on the hook as a, you know, as a exponent of colonialism, right? Because it means something violent happened in order to get this. The building, at minimum, the building had to be torn down somehow in order to get this piece. And of course, it's much more than that.
Absolutely. I mean, what is interesting in the research that I did to write this book, I kept trying to find clear evidence of how, you know, a certain object got from being part of a building to being in a museum collection. It was actually very difficult to find anything documenting the actual process, right? Often I would find bits and pieces, usually in, let's say, the travel narratives that, like, you know, European anthropologists wrote or collectors wrote in the 19th century, but even in the 20th century, right? But they wouldn't detail like exactly what happened. How did this thing get into their hands? Often that entire kind of process was missing from the record, right? And so, you know, to some extent, the argument I'm making is based on, you know, a kind of logical leap, right? Because if there's no explanation about how this object that was, you know, a structural object got from being in a building and the person who collected it saw it standing in the building, right? And then somehow now it's after the person leaves, it's presumably in some kind of ship, and then it's, you know, then it's in a museum. If there's no explanation, it seems more likely than not that some kind of illicit process happened. To be fair, I think it's important to emphasize that we do have some documentation, some, you know, letters and notes and things like that that say, oh, I bought this object from its owner, right? But even that needs to be like really complicated a little bit. Like, again, if the object was, you know, standing in the building and you go up to a person and say, I really like your door, I'm going to buy it from you, you know, like, how does that process actually work, right? There were cases, again, noted in the documentation that say, okay, I visited this village or this town, and there was a stack of these things in the corner, and I purchased them, or no, there's no commentary on how you got from, you know, seeing a stack of columns and then owning one of those columns, right? So it must be said that in some cases there was some kind of purchase that needs to be complicated. In some cases, the objects were not actually installed in a building. Okay, that's interesting as well, but you still have to, you know, really, I think, drill down a little further and try to understand what this process of like transfer was.
Could you give a few examples of what does exist in the historical record? I think you quote at one point, you know, one of the kings of Ethiopia, which of course always an independent kingdom, writing very politely to the British if they could return some of the objects they stole when they, you know, I don't know, British troops blew up the fort of a sovereign nation. Some of the stuff that does exist is pretty wild to think about, of course, wild in its own historical, horrific way, yes.
Right, absolutely. I think you're referring to the king of a city called Magdala in Ethiopia that, you know, was kind of holding out against the British, and there was a, you know, a siege, and the British, I believe this was 1872, you know, sort of destroyed the fort and you know, in the process, and, you know, as soon as they arrived at the fort, collected everything of value. And the fort, you know, Ethiopia was a kind of a Christian kingdom. They have an early, you know, version of Christianity, and they had and still have many wonderful works of art, you know, whether it's fresco paintings or, you know, religious, you know, artifacts, crosses and things like that. But they also collected, like, you know, the robes and the crown of the, you know, emperor and all of this stuff. So in that particular case, I did not find anything that seemed particularly architectural in character, although one could argue that some of the frescoes and you know, sort of paintings on the wall, some of which were not painted directly on the wall, but were on some kind of textile, you know, sort of canvas, and then were removed from the wall. One could argue that those are, you know, sort of really architectural in character, maybe not structural, but, you know, sort of architectural in character. But there are many other, you know, sort of examples. The most famous, of course, being the British campaign against the Kingdom of Benin, which I call Edo Benin. Edo is actually the name that the indigenous people of that kingdom give to themselves. I am of Edo descent. We call ourselves Edo people, but the Portuguese didn't understand and they called us Benin people. And since then we've been the Benin kingdom. So I reclaim that and call it you know, the kingdom, the Edo Benin kingdom. In the book. And in 1897, famously, the British attacked and burned to the ground the capital city and surrounding towns and villages of the Edo Benin Kingdom, mostly because they wanted access to you know, various resources, palm oil, and they had also heard that the kingdom had a large treasury of ivory and gold and all of these precious things. And so under false pretexts, and, you know, it's still debated about like what exactly happened that triggered the siege, but it's clear, and I'm not, you know, the one who made this claim, but other historians have kind of looked at the records in detail. It's clear that, you know, British policy was eventually leading towards this outcome, like, and whatever it was that triggered it, this was going to be the outcome they attacked. And in this case, this was in February 1897, not only did they, you know, sort of attack and kill people, they deliberately burned down the city, and in that process actually took thousands, and we're still trying to actually, you know, determine what the actual number of objects was that were taken from the kingdom. And in the process of taking these objects, they actively searched out these objects, right? People hid their things, but they went and, you know, dug into the ground, dug into walls, you know, very deliberately tried to find every piece of, you know, important material, cultural, artistic, architectural heritage that they could, and took it back, you know, to England. With them. And so one of the interesting things about that whole story is that, you know, as a result of that, the art objects of this particular kingdom have become extremely valuable in the Western art market since 1897. There's a scholar that recently did a kind of, you know, economic analysis of like the kind of increase in value of these art objects from the Kingdom of Edo Benin, and the way in which the media and art historians and collectors kind of through their correspondence, through their commentary on these works, actually increase the value, right? So today they're some of the most valuable works of African art in Western museums. But what is interesting to me is that some of those objects, you know, are objects that were built into buildings. They were parts of buildings. Some of them were decorative, but even the decorative ones, you know, can we really argue that was their sole function? They probably had the function of sort of documenting history, you know, in sort of in a society that did not, historically write down its history. There are other means of documenting and keeping history, right? Maintaining the history and the memory of the society. And one of those was through artworks and, you know, art objects and the motifs that were kind of, you know, included in them. And so, you know, the palace famously, in one of its major courtyards, Europeans, when they visited in the 15th century, in the 17th century, in the 18th century, and again in 1897, in the 19th century, you know, found that the courtyard was, the columns of that supported the veranda of the courtyard were enclosed and cased in these brass sort of plaques that are now found in any major museum in the world has at least one of the Edo Benin brass plaques. And again, they've been thought of as art objects because they were removed, you know, from the plaques, and they and now they're displayed sort of, you know, flat on a wall. But in fact, in my view, they were an integral part of the architecture and the design of that courtyard, right? They would have shaped the way you saw the courtyard, the way you moved through the courtyard, the motifs, you know, told stories and kind of documented the history. And so though there are so many plaques, in fact, a recent scholar commented that if they were laid side to side, all of these plaques would, I think she said, cover, you know, almost 2,000 square feet in space. So that's how many, you know, plaques there were. In my view, one could argue that that's an architectural object. That is not just a work of art. It's, you know, it was integral to the space and the experience of that royal palace. And that's just one example, you know, of kind of violent, you know, removal. And it was just really interesting to read some of the diaries of some of the British soldiers who were involved in this, you know, horrific act. And to recognize that they actually understood what they were doing as a cultural genocide, and that they were deliberately taking away what they thought were the most important cultural artifacts, you know, of this kingdom in order to subjugate it. So, you know, art and architecture become involved in a kind of political, political act, really.
I think there's another important distinction that comes up in your work, which is to look at, well, you want to, I think you want to expose under the lens equally, at least, the whole process around removing Egyptian artifacts, architecture, and that of the sub-Saharan region, everywhere south of the Sahara. Why is that distinction important?
Yeah, the sub-Saharan Africa, kind of North Africa distinction is a vexed kind of discussion in the history of African and just African history in general. And then furthermore, Egypt often is not even like in the popular imagination, it's really not understood as being part of North Africa and certainly not part of like sub-Saharan Africa. There seem to be these really kind of distinct things, and Egypt has historically kind of been included in a story about, you know, the kind of history of humanity that originates in the sort of Mediterranean world and influences the ancient Greeks and then the ancient Romans and then obviously Europe, right? So that's the story we usually tell about Egypt. And the fact that Egypt obviously physically is located on the African continent, and we know that it had very close relationships with its southern neighbors, you know, throughout history. In fact, there were certain points in time when Egypt was ruled by, like, you know, its southern neighbors, right? Sudan and so on. And so for me, it's really important just in general in all my work, whether it's my teaching or my writing, to really emphasize to people that this kind of distinction that has been drawn historically between Egypt and the rest of the African continent is false, right, and problematic. And then I think using the history of the removal of material culture from Egypt and linking that to a much later history of the removal of material culture, including architecture, from other parts of the African continent, from, you know, neighbors to the north, and, you know, the rest of the African continent to the south, is really important, because it illustrates that this particular pattern has been in place for a long time. And that, you know, the 19th century and early 20th century variants that I focus on primarily in the book, although I do have examples from the 18th century, and I even go back to like the 15th century when, you know, the Portuguese first kind of, you know, sailed to, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, and, you know, sort of engaged with, you know, the ancient city-states on the kind of southeastern part of the continent, and also, you know, Europeans engaging with Congo region of the continent and sending back objects, you know, that they collected or thought were important. I think to show that this pattern has a long history helps us just understand what is going on better. And for me, you know, I think here in the United States, you know, we are so used to seeing Egyptian objects in museums, we don't even question them anymore to some extent, right? They're these monumental pieces and, you know, folks don't say like, okay, well, like, but why? Why is this here? And how did such a large object get here? And what happened to the rest of what it was part of, right? And so I wanted to really make folks more aware and to encourage them that when they go into museum spaces to really look closely and think more broadly about what they're looking at.
Well, pivoting from the horrific circumstances in which they were stolen, you obviously make a case that there's a strong moral case for restitution here. And it's been interesting that there seems to be a growing recognition, however so slowly, that restitution is necessary. I saw that the government of the Netherlands belatedly returned some of the bronzes last year, of course, only a fraction. But yeah, what does it mean to, you know, obviously restitution is fraught for those institutions, even for the West, the Elgin Marbles being a classic example coming out of like how the British Museum is happy to oppress the Greek government demands for this, let alone sub-Saharan African governments. What will it take, or what have you seen in terms of successful tactics to have the recognition of the material culture of sub-Saharan African nations and having their claims honored for return? I guess, do you have advice? Do you have a plan of action of like how to put the pressure on these governments and institutions to do it?
I mean, I think raising popular consciousness is a really important, just understanding and knowledge is a really important part of that process. And I think that's what has happened in the last like decade or so. Because as I point out in the book, and other folks have pointed this out too, you know, if we're talking about Africans, and we can talk separately about the Greeks and the Elgin Marbles, but you know, various, well, contemporary nation states now on the African continent have been asking for their objects back for basically ever since they were taken, right? In one form or the other, they've requested. Sometimes they've purchased objects back, which is, you know, something that just still really gets me very upset that an African, and in this case, I'm thinking about Nigeria, would have to purchase back from the British Museum or some other museum, you know, objects that were taken during the colonial period. That just seems extraordinarily problematic, right? So in terms of tactics, I think I talk in the book about the Benin Dialogue Group, which was a group of primarily museum professionals across Central Europe and also in the United States, who got together with representatives from the Royal Palace of the Edo Benin Kingdom to really collaborate on in terms of thinking about how to kind of resolve what has really become, you know, a problem. The fact that the majority of the material cultural heritage of this kingdom is now found outside the kingdom, and folks who are in Nigeria, who are, you know, across the African continent, don't have access to them because they're elsewhere. And so the Benin Dialogue Group was formed, I believe, in the early 2000s. And, you know, I think, again, what differentiates what has happened in, so early 2000s, that's almost, you know, 26 years ago now, so not a decade, but longer, what really differentiates what has happened in these last 20 years versus what has happened before is that some folks in, you know, outside of the African continent have sort of gotten, become awakened to the need to really do something about this problem, right? And have adopted a stance where they are open and willing to discuss with, you know, representatives from various, you know, parts of the continent and to come up with the game plan. So I would really place much of the success that has happened in the recent decades in terms of returns, and there have been a number of returns from the United States. RISD Museum returned its only object from Edo, Benin a couple of years ago. The Smithsonian return in Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian Museum of Art, African Art, returned some of its objects. There are other Benin objects in other Smithsonian museums as well. The MFA in Boston, I believe, returned something. And so I would say that a lot of credit needs to be given to this particular group for at least kind of really resuscitating what had been, you know, longstanding requests by the original owners of these objects, and then bringing those requests to sort of, you know, museum leaders here in the United States and in Europe, and then governments in Europe, like the government of France, you know, has returned objects to the République du Bénin, which is completely a different country in West Africa. And the German government has returned a good number of Benin objects to Nigeria. So yes, I think, you know, sort of pressure from scholars, historians, museum professionals, but also from the general public visiting museums and asking questions, and of course from the original owners of these and makers of these things is really important.
Well, yes, to your point there about raising consciousness and visiting museums, longtime listeners may remember back in season 3, we had Ludi's Chidi Nwabani on to talk a bit about his group's sort of fun efforts there to basically raid the British Museum to make augmented reality scans of the Rosetta Stone and some of the bronzes and pursue what he referred to as digital repatriation, which he understood obviously as sort of a poke in the eye, that nothing can compare to that. But also that exhibit Dan and I encountered in the 2023 Venice Architecture Biennale, which was curated by Leslie Loco, who runs the African Futures Institute in Accra. I'm curious, obviously, I mean, how the theft and destruction of Africa's architectural vernacular denied those societies a language to carry through their architecture. And that year's Biennale, I interpreted as sort of a retro history of what could have been, and then obviously a lot of Afro futures as well. And I guess I wanted to ask is there, obviously these cover many different societies, but are there efforts by architects and others to recapture some of this vernacular, to understand these objects and carry forward what might have been that continuity of a, you know, pan sub-Saharan African architectural vernacular and material culture?
Yeah. There are a small number of efforts, I would say. And the hope is that with, you know, a book like this, and then with all the work that, you know, activists are doing and museum folks and government officials as well, that number one, there will be increased awareness of what that heritage is, what those architectural traditions were, because I think that is where there's a gap and there's just silence, right? Folks don't know literally what their ancestors did. I'm not arguing that there has been no continuity and no transfer of knowledge, over time. There certainly has been, and there continue to be craftspeople who, you know, work in wood and in bronze, and most of that knowledge has been, you know, transferred orally. But it's one thing to transfer knowledge orally. It's one thing to be surrounded by examples that you can look to, right, to really understand how people use the materials that are indigenous to the region, and also, you know, what kinds of motifs are, you know, historical to the region, and to think about how those motifs and materials and building technologies, if and how they can be useful for today's environment. I think looking at actual examples is such an important part of that, and one that folks have not been able to do because of this huge transfer, quote unquote. I don't like that word because it kind of neutralizes what happened, you know, but we'll use it for the sake of, you know, just language, this huge transfer of knowledge and objects that happened, you know, certainly throughout the 19th century and before. So one example of someone who, or a group of architects who's actually thinking about that is Ajay Associates, right? In their new design, and it's currently under construction for the Museum of West African Art in Benin City, Nigeria. Benin City is and was the capital of the Edo-Benin Kingdom that was raided by the British in 1897. In the original designs for that project, and the designs, as we know, we know how the design process works and things change over time. But in the original designs for that project, there was a concerted effort to really think about what the Edo-Benin vernacular was. The use of earth was really important in Edo-Benin buildings. It's a particular type of laterite that is available. That's the only soil available in the region. It's bright red, it stains your clothes, you know, it's very dusty, but the Edo-Benin people had found a way to mix it with various, you know, organic substances to create a building material that was pretty hard. And that building material, you know, created all the walls of the royal palace and of houses, in the 19th century, and still is sometimes used today. And those walls have a very distinct, number one, coloration, right? And then a distinct kind of material texture to them because of this very, very particular type of soil. And so in the original designs for the MoWA Museum in Benin City, Ajay Associates was looking at that vernacular and trying to come up with a kind of concrete product that would not, I wouldn't say mimic it, but that would certainly reference it, right? And so on the level of kind of color and texture, that was one of the goals. And then also on the level of the actual forms of the structures, the architects also looked at, you know, the sort of historical rectilinear kind of module that was the baseline for all buildings in Edo Benin, and then the, you know, the steeply pitched roof, and then the bronze or brass snakes that kind of decorated the roofs of the royal palace, but that I argue probably served other more functional purposes as well. And so you see references to those elements in the original designs for the MoWA Museum. And then furthermore, the MoWA Museum is on a site that was originally part of the very, very large land area that took up the royal palace in the 19th century. And so an archaeological dig was constructed as part of the, performed as part of the pre-work, you know, for the construction of this new museum. And, potsherds and other, you know, artifacts that were found on the site are also being integrated into the design. Again, I'm referencing a very early phase in the design process of the structure that's now under construction. The ideas have changed a little bit, but I do still see some of those references to that particular vernacular. So that's one very clear example. But that, again, that is because of an engagement and a knowledge of the building types that existed, the materials that were used traditionally and historically, and then also the program of the museum, which originally was in part to house some of the returned objects. So there were very strong reasons to really look backwards, so to speak, and to think about how previous materials, forms, and technologies could inform this new museum.
And so you're speaking in some of these things in the past tense and talking about former designs or early designs. What is the current status of the MoWA that you're alluding to?
Yeah, the current status of the MoA, unfortunately, it has it turned into a very controversial project. They had a soft launch of one of the buildings that is part of the now much more extensive kind of project. So originally it was a museum, and it has become, you know, a museum, artists' studios. In fact, I think there was a plan for a hotel of some kind. It's now more of an arts district kind of idea. And they built one of those buildings within this arts district kind of proposal that evolved and emerged from the original proposal. And there was a soft opening late last year, and there were protests at the soft opening by some local people, and those protests, shut down the soft opening, and they really emphasized the somewhat not controversial but challenged nature of this project, even from local eyes. Right, there was a sense that the project is really something imposed by outside forces, and it isn't quite the homegrown museum that was originally proposed and imagined. And I think there was just really, there needed to have been more communication with the local community to get buy-in for this project, and to have them understand that this is not another effort to kind of claim their indigenous heritage, but it has really positive motivations, which maybe haven't been communicated properly. So that's what has happened in terms of kind of the politics around the museum. And then because of those politics, the museum has, and the whole project, designed by Ajay Associates, has moved away from the original idea of really providing a home for repatriated objects from, whether it's the British Museum or the Met, in New York, or any one of, major museums around the Western world. So they've moved away from that because, again, there's been a sense by some members of the local population that, in fact, this is just another kind of colonial effort. Design-wise, as I said, the main change really has been an expansion of the scope of the project to become this much more like contemporary arts district, kind of idea. And I do think that the goals of the project, which were to revitalize local arts, through this new arts district, and to make Benin City a kind of destination for tourists and scholars and whoever, for the arts, could be economically beneficial to the city and to the region, which is part of, what was articulated. I really do think that it could have those benefits, but it has become, sort of controversial for many reasons.
So thinking more, let's say, optimistically about the future, we've talked about, how there is an emerging consciousness and a project to repatriate as much stolen art and architecture as possible back to Africa, and to find a way to restitch those broken connections that people have with their own pasts. If we're looking at the future, do you see strands? I mean, it sounds like this MoA project, although it seems to have gotten maybe a little bit bloated, and that's one of the concerns, it is starting to drive forward a way to stitch the past to a material, to preserve a material culture and to propel it forward. Do you see artists, institutions, architects, government entities, any kind of entity figuring out where to take this next? Like, suppose that this movement becomes more successful in returning the cultural heritage to the place from which it was taken, how do we then turn this into a future-oriented project? Have you seen strands of that happening?
Not quite yet, but I'm hoping that some of the work that I'm doing will, you know, contribute toward that. I think there are a couple different possibilities, right? And I discussed them briefly in the book as well. So one possibility is what we just talked about with regards to MOA and efforts to think about not only the program in the case of MOA as a museum that was originally meant to house some of these repatriated objects, but also from a material point of view, a building technology point of view, formal point of view to make those connections to past ways of building and to envision how those can influence the present. So MOA is one example. The Musée des Civilisation Noire, Museum of Black Civilizations in Dakar, is another example. I would say it was less successful from an architectural point of view in terms of really communicating, you know, a kind of architecture that is thinking closely about, you know, available materials, available and sustainable technologies and things like that. I think it's a little less successful. It also tries formally to kind of make connections there. I would say those are a little less successful. So that's one route, is in terms of contemporary architectural practice, right? And architects, you know, sort of engaging with new knowledge about African, you know, architectural histories. That's one approach. Another approach that I've been thinking about is in terms of sort of museums of African architecture, particularly, right? And so here in the United States and you know, in Europe, parts of Europe, there's a long tradition of open air museums where you have kind of historical buildings that are, you know, placed to create a kind of reenactment of what the past was. And there are many, many examples across the United States. I'm thinking of like Colonial Williamsburg as a kind of one example of that kind of approach. And that's a way for both the, you know, the popular, you know, the regular people, the masses, everyone in the population to kind of learn about their history and about what their architectural history would have been. And it can also serve as a source for, again, both artists and architects in terms of looking for inspiration from the past and so on. And we don't have many examples of those kinds of open air museum spaces that include, you know, actual original examples of historical African architecture. And I would suggest that that could be another avenue, you know, the creation of more of these kinds of spaces using some of these restituted or returned architectural elements, because the two that I know of in sub-Saharan Africa one is called the Village Museum. It's in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, and it has kind of, you know, it's a kind of large open space with examples of buildings that were historically built by certain ethnic groups, and it's kind of organized in an ethnic or anthropological way to show those cultures by showing what they built, how they built in the past. Now the problem is all of those examples are new, so to speak. There aren't actually any historical buildings in that space, right? And I wonder, for instance, if some of these objects, obviously, we don't necessarily have entire buildings, although I do believe that there's some. I'm still hunting them down. I've read, you know, collectors, 19th century journals where they talk about taking entire buildings home, right? I haven't found them in the archives yet. Maybe they were dismembered. Maybe they were taken apart and then different pieces sent to different museums. But I do have examples where people talked about taking entire buildings. They called them huts, of course, which is a problematic term, but entire buildings back home. So we don't have that, but we do have these fragments, whether they can be reconstituted, you know, through research to create at least partial reconstructions of historical buildings, or whether we just are dealing with fragments and those fragments can be incorporated into contemporary, you know, reconstructions by craftspeople, thinking about what those historical structures were like. I think there's some possibility. I think it offers economic opportunity as well, you know, some kinds of new museums that would be built in various parts of the continent. So I mentioned the one in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. There's another one in northern Nigeria called the Joss Museum. It's a museum of architecture, Nigerian architecture. Again, as far as I know, no actual historical examples. They're reconstructions, right? And so those are two things that I've been playing with and just, you know, kind of thinking about the contemporary practice and how it can at least become more fully aware of historical technologies and materials and perhaps allow those to shape a more sustainable practice. And when I say a more sustainable practice, I'm not using sustainability necessarily in terms of a kind of environmental sustainability, although it might have that effect, but I'm thinking about the fact that so many buildings on the African continent rely on cement, which, you know, and other imported materials. Like, how can we build in a way that is not relying on imported materials, but is actually using local materials? So I imagine that there is something to be learned from historical buildings, to solve that contemporary problem.
I've certainly seen examples of this kind of thing being done in, cultures other than North America, where, you know, our sense of historic preservation is somewhat different from the rest of the world, where things move very fast. I mean, like, you know, China's an ancient society, but they've also been systematically bulldozing historic neighborhoods left and right in the name of growth and prosperity, but they have preserved a couple of key neighborhoods, and in some cases it's mere facadism, in others it's about trying to propel that Chinese material culture forward into the 21st century. I think that the danger with those types of things, that as I've seen them, you know, things like Xintiandi in Shanghai, is that it's kind of basically just a mall, and it's a mall with some nice, you know, turn of the last century, you know, facades from the time when, you know, Sun Yat-sen was putting together the Chinese Communist Party, et cetera. So there's historicism associated with it. There's culture kind of being referenced, but it's not like the living museum that you would want to see that would teach vernacular construction techniques. And so my hope for, you know, Africa is that we kind of look at we look at efforts to preserve culture, but we don't just preserve it in amber. We try to propel it forward into the contemporary context. And so maybe some of these other examples where indeed Chinese contractors, Middle Eastern contractors are all working all over Africa right now, changing the face of especially big cities. How do we channel that energy so that we don't make the same mistakes that we did the last time we had a lot of foreign influence, in Africa?
Well, I would say other thoughts I was having. I had a conversation earlier today with a former head of sustainability at a major architecture firm who left because she was not super impressed by their commitment. But we were discussing Julia Watson, who has the book Low Tech and other books, where she points out examples of, indigenous knowledge around the world too, but also several examples of vernacular in Kenya is in here, in desert living. And firms like Mass Design Group in Rwanda are trying to do this in terms of local construction and material as well, and try to sort of learn from local conditions and carry that forward. And one institution did mention, because it's back in the art world, but I am curious, since listeners know we're Biennale fans, the late Koyo Kuo, who will be the curator of the Art Biennale opening this year, is poised to announce its lineup of artists at the end of February. So it'll be very interesting to see who she selected as the curator of Zeitz MoCA to carry through perhaps some of those themes as well. So lots there.
No, there's a lot happening on the African continent in the art world, and some happening in the architecture world. And obviously the two worlds, I think, should talk to each other more. I believe someone is organizing, I believe his name is Omar Dugan. He's trying to organize an African architecture biennale. So that should be interesting if he succeeds. I believe there might be an event happening September 2026. And so I'm hoping to be there as well.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds awesome.
If so, we'll see you there. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Sign me up. Yeah. Excellent. Well, Ito, thank you so much for joining us on Unfrozen today. This has been a really illuminating conversation. And I think we've learned an awful lot from reading this book, and I hope that everyone else will too. So please go check it out. It's Africa's Buildings, Architecture and the Displacement of Cultural Heritage. Ijohan Osayimuse.